Blog Talk Radio.
Lay your hands on the radio. Lay your hands on the radio there in the home.
It's that psychedelic time of the year. Do you know where your brain cells are?
Blog Talk Radio.
You know, there's an enormous industry in this nation that is churning out day after day at the cost of billions of dollars the sensation, entirely erroneous, in the body politic that everything is okay and everything's going to keep on being just the way it is now on into the indefinite future. But of course,
Radio Free Canada
have not purchased that bill of goods.
Remember, all I'm offering is the truth.
You can handle the truth!
Welcome to Radio Free Kansas.
Kansas.
I'm your host, Mike Dell, broadcasting from North Jefferson County, Kansas.
Good and I'm friendly to strangers. napping. One day they'll kill me. Then I'll be gone. But that won't be my end. For my guns and my saddle will always be filled by unwelcome travelers and other brave.
Singing Crib Sheets. Now, those are the words of Woody Guthrie set to music by Billy Bragg. Unwelcome Guests, which, by the way, is a great series of programs. There are almost, I think, up to 500 shows at the RadioForAll.net network, the A-Info radio project, where a lot of programming I put on Radio Free Kansas comes from. We'll do some promos. At the bottom of the hour, we'll have Stan Cox. At the bottom of the hour, just a few minutes away. Stay with us. Welcome to Radio Free Kansas, May 7th, 2011.
Hi, this is Peter B. Collins. I'm based in San Francisco. I'm a veteran radio talk show host. And I want to ask you to spread the word about the new website that Sibel Edmonds has set up called BoilingFrogsPost.com. I've been working with Sibel on the Boiling Frogs podcast interview series for the last few months. And every time we talk with a whistleblower, from the FBI, the National Security Agency, the CIA, the Drug Enforcement Agency, each one of these whistleblowers has something in common. And that is, when their cases hit a critical point, they expected the mainstream media, the corporate media, to dig into their story, to expose the wrongdoing, and to hold the people responsible accountable for it. And while there are significant failures of congressional oversight, government prosecutions, we have relied on the media in this country to be an important fourth estate, the watchdog on those who run our government and control our treasure. And what's very clear is that the media have failed us, particularly in the last 8 to 10 years. And so Sibel has recruited some of the best journalists in the country, people who have focused on national security issues, our foreign policy, some of the most critical matters that we face and that American citizens deserve to be well informed about. And over the next few months, you're going to hear more powerful interviews with whistleblowers and others who have important information. And you're also going to see very important articles and commentaries posted on the website. If you're able to help support this effort with a contribution, I'd really appreciate it. But most importantly, spread the word. Right now, if you could send out 10 emails to people you know, alerting them to the Boiling Frogs Post website, that would accomplish a lot. You can email me, peter@peterbcollins.com, and my podcasts are available at iTunes or at peterbcollins.com. I look forward to continuing to work with Sibel to make more people aware of critical information and issues that, I'm sad to say, you'll probably only find at BoilingFrogsPost.com.
Listeners, we're in for a treat. Actually, you're in for a treat because I've got something to tell you about. For the last 2 years, I've been buying Hudson Cream Flour and it's made here in Kansas by Kansans, and it's a great product. I love it. I use it. My wife makes pie crust out of it, and I use it in my bread machine, and it works. And guess who I have on the phone? Mr. Raul Foote from what county is that up down there, and what county again?
Stafford County.
Stafford County in Hudson, Kansas. Welcome to Radio Free Kansas, Mr. Foote. Could you give us a little background about your product and where did it come from? How did it work?
Okay, our product is Hudson Cream Flour. And this company was founded in 1904 by a German immigrant named Gustav Krug.
Oh.
So we've been in business, 106 years?
Gracious.
We're an independent mill, privately owned. The Hudson Cream Flour label is ours, and it's a short patent flour, which means it's a finer grind of flour. It's lower in ash, and it's silkier feeling than a lot of the flours out there, which makes the texture of the products more silkier.
That makes sense. I was wondering about that, because when I use it, I notice that there's something different about the flour. It's also available in local Kansas grocery stores. That's a big deal to me, too, right there along the big names. I mean, and really reasonably priced. It's, in many respects, it's, you know, listeners, you'll have a Better for Bread mark, and then right next to it, here's Hudson Cream, made in Kansas, Hudson, Kansas, and you just heard Mr. Foote, and the stuff is, good grief, maybe a dollar a bag cheaper. It's amazing. This is good stuff. That's why it's sifted or something, or what is this, ground? It's ground more?
No, it goes through one more sifting process than most of the flours. So basically we pull off the low-grade flour and sell it separately.
Uh-huh.
And then we take the short patent flour, and then that's what the Hudson Cream flour is. The byproduct is called clear.
Huh, I've never heard of it.
How long
have you been with the company, and tell us a little bit about the place it's made at, Hudson, Kansas.
I've been here 33 years. The town of Hudson is around 125 people, and we employ 34.
Well, where in Kansas is Hudson?
Just about, if you took a map and put a pin right in the middle of Kansas, that's where we'd be. We're 45 miles west of Hutchison and 23 miles south of Great Bend.
Approximately how many grocery stores in Kansas carry it? Because I know I've checked in. I know Country Mart up in Atchison, Country Mart in Holton, and Steve's IGA in Valley Falls. They all three have it. Do you know how many have it?
All the Dillon stores have it.
Good.
And any store that gets their flour from AWG out of Kansas City will have it.
And I'm sure you can ask listeners your local grocery store, and they'll get it for you, especially in Kansas. Your secretary told me yesterday when I was lining up our little talk here that quite a bit shipped out of state towards the east.
Yeah, we sell in the Appalachian states, West Virginia, Virginia, Kentucky, Ohio, North Carolina, and Tennessee.
I did not know that. What people want to get a hold of you, you're on the internet too. This is another wonderful surprise. Could you give us your web address?
We have a web address of staffordcountyflourmills.com or hudsoncream.com.
Excellent. All right.
And you can get us on either one of those. And there's a history and everything on there that you can see about the company, and all of that's on there available, too.
Well, you know, I'm sorry to bother you on a busy Friday. I understand you got some construction going on down there, but I appreciate your time spent with us on Radio Free Kansas, Mr. Foote.
Well, thank you, and thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you.
Uh-huh. Goodbye.
Weren't the new Tea Party lawmakers going to change business as usual in Congress? I'll tell you what happened today on Hightower Radio.
That's right, the return of Jim Hightower, the one of America's best populist Hightower Radio. This is a great one. Here it is with the Tea Party. The chat box is open, by the way.
They came, they saw, they conquered. This line pretty well sums up a little reported but important story about the new Tea Partiers in the U.S. House of Representatives. No sooner had they arrived than the corporate lobbying corps came to visit, saw what these supposed rebels were made of, and quickly conquered them without a fight. The forces of big business needed only to lay out some campaign cash, and quicker than you can say business as usual, the budding lawmakers snatched up the money and immediately began carrying the lobbyists' corporate agenda. Check out the Financial Service Subcommittee, which handles legislation affecting Wall Street bankers. Five Tea Partiers got coveted slots on this panel, and all five were suddenly showered with big donations from such financial lobbying interests as Goldman Sachs. Now, all five are sponsoring bills to undo parts of the recent reforms to rein in Wall Street excesses. Steve Strivers of Ohio, for example, hauled in nearly $100,000 in just his first 2 months in office, 85% of it from the special interests his committee oversees. He insists that the cash he took from Goldman Sachs and others has nothing to do with his subsequent support of bills that Goldman is lobbying so strongly for. Stivers claims that his sole legislative focus is on jobs for Ohio's 15th district. Really? Among the Deform the Reform bills that Steve is carrying is one to let Wall Street giants avoid disclosing the difference in what the CEO is paid and what average employees make. Another would exempt billionaire private equity hucksters from regulation. I can see that these bills are great job extenders for the barons of Wall Street, but how do they create a single job in his district? This is Jim Hightower saying, this stuff does nothing but shelter the greed-headed banksters who wrecked our economy. Is that what the Tea Party Rebellion was all about?
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
That was Jeff Lux, one of the founding members of the band Kansas. You've all heard of that band. Well, he's still around. One of the founding members of the band Kansas took his own path. That was, you could catch him and get his MP3s at Jeff Lux, that's L-U-X, jefflux.com. Here's one more, Hard Gun, and then we'll play some more from Jim Herman and the Hermanators to finish up the half hour. Welcome to Radio Free. Stan Cox.
pay taxes anytime. Working man still got payroll tax, loses his job, falls through the cracks. No health care, so when he gets sick, he'll go to the doctors. Where's my trickle? Down, 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 down. When producing jobs, it's a matter of time. The Indian China's doing just fine. Rise of tide, just grab the boat. What I want to know is where's my phone?
Dream.
Yes, Jim Herman. Hello. Hey, it worked. Hey. My gadget worked. Hey, Stan.
Yeah.
All right, man. You're on air. Welcome to Radio Free Kansas.
I've never
used my gadget before where I could call my guests. And I'm.
Oh, this is the first.
I'm sort of, yeah.
Well, sounds like it worked.
Well, yes, it did. Listeners, welcome Stan Cox to Radio Free Kansas. I've been telling all my listeners and email people about your writings. Dude, what a great, man, you're getting all kinds of stuff out there, aren't you?
No, thanks. Well, when I wrote the book, Losing Our Cool, about air conditioning, and it came out in June last year, I was kind of hoping for a really hot summer to generate some interest, and I kind of felt guilty when across the country everybody was hit by heat wave after heat wave, but it did help get some attention to the book.
Well, you know, I don't know about the heat wave. We sort of missed the bullet here in Kansas, in East Kansas, but West Kansas, the end-timer, crazy born-again Governor Brownback has declared, I guess, a part of Kansas a drought, western Kansas. And I guess it's tough stuff down there in Texas. And I don't know. You know, what I do know is that you're a great writer and you're getting out there all over the place except in Kansas. I guess the Salina Journal, that's your local newspaper, isn't it, Stan?
Right, yeah. For a while, they were running op-eds that I wrote, but they haven't. The last couple, they didn't run. I don't know what the trouble is.
Well, so you have a good relationship with some of these people that publish in Kansas, publish your op-ed stuff?
Yeah, well, we used to, at the Land Institute where I work, we had what was called the Prairie Writers Circle, which put out on a approximately monthly basis, put out op-eds, and there were several of us writing for that. That's not going anymore, but I still do it on my own.
Sure. Well, what do you think is, how would you, I want to spend about Losing Our Cool just a little bit, because I'd like to hear your other stuff, what you're talking about and writing about. But Losing Our Cool, you know, that's sort of that's a timely subject now. We're getting ready. It's probably 80 degrees here on the back porch here in North Jefferson County on my 10 acres, and got a couple house guests here listening in, and you know, I'm wondering what what's your beef? Let me just be the devil's advocate here, Stan. What's your beef with air conditioning?
Well, probably the two main motives I had in writing it, and then once I got into it, I found a lot of other stuff, but the two main things, one is that the cord that goes into the wall or the power line that comes into your house that runs the air conditioning is connected at the other end to a power plant, almost certainly a fossil fuel plant, and 50% of the time coal. Therefore, we've had hotter and hotter summers, causing people to use air conditioning more and more, which is contributing that much more to global warming, which will mean they'll be needing to run air conditioning even more in the future. And so that vicious circle needs to be broken at some point. And obviously we use a lot of technologies that depend on fossil fuel, but we're approaching our residential electricity consumption nationwide is approaching 20% going to air conditioning. And even though in the past dozen years or so, the efficiency of air conditioning equipment has improved dramatically, like 28%, the amount of energy being used per air-conditioned household for air conditioning has gone up 37%. So we've got more efficient equipment, but it's using more energy because of the increased use of air conditioning.
Because there's more people using it now, right?
Yeah. But the other kind of reason in a different sphere that I was interested in writing it will be illustrated here in the next few weeks, because we go through a whole winter, and in the cities and suburbs in Kansas and everywhere, people are kind of shut up inside. And then for a couple of weeks in spring, suddenly you see people outside, and people get to know their neighbors again, and there's some socializing. And then, wham, people reshut their windows, seal their houses up, and you walk down a street on a pleasant 80-degree summer evening, and there's not a human in sight, and the only sound you're hearing is the humming of compressors. So it has contributed, along with electronic entertainment and other things, to, a deterioration in the social fabric.
That's no kidding. You know, one of the things, we try not to run our air conditioner at all, as much as we can, until, like I said, late August at nighttime, when it's so hot in the upstairs of our 10-acre farmhouse. And and we really try to avoid it, because there is, what you said, that kick-in. But one thing I noticed is what my stepfather used to call a heat-water transfer. If you don't start the AC up until, this might be a myth, if you don't start the AC up till like 11 o'clock at night and close all your windows, then you've got he explained that there's a load transfer. You've got to move this water out of the air upstairs. It's just the upstairs. And that will, before you really feel the cool. So, he says it. So, of course, he's dead now. But his advice at that time was, well, that's why you got to run it all the time.
well, it is true that it takes a lot of energy to bring the temperature and the humidity down initially. But especially if you're using a room air conditioner, say only cooling the bedroom, you can cool a room like that off pretty fast. And it certainly, if you're running it for a few hours, it's certainly using a lot less electricity than if it were running full time, and certainly if it were cooling an entire house full time, that's a lot more energy. And that's one, the move from room air conditioners to central air in the past couple of decades has really contributed to a lot of the increased power consumption.
Well, I never believed him in the first place, and I just turned it on 11. Well, by midnight or 12:30, it was cooled off enough that I could I could do that. And by 3 or 4 in the morning, it was almost refrigerated. And I don't know if listeners, a lot of my listeners get my email blast. I was talking about the old days of hauling hay and working of that oil rig, that pulling rig. And, my grandmother told us she would never, you know what she did? She just sealed the upstairs off in her little, her two-story house, and we just didn't go up there. The only time I remember her going up there is when her homebrew got too hot. She would make homebrew beer, and it blew all the tops off the caps up there. It sounded like a artillery barrage. And she was embarrassed because, people in Leroy, Kansas just don't drink beer, let alone make their own in public. And when those same explosions went off, even the neighbors came over and wondered if there'd been something going on up there in the attic. Well, what she'd done is the beer got too hot up there, the green beer, and it blew the caps off of the thing. And I was 6 years old, and that's when I learned about the qualities of home brew. She just sealed it off, and she told me stories. I guess when it get real hot, people would go camp out in the little city park there in Leroy, or sleep out in the porch in the cherry position with the glider, the swing. Mm-hmm. And she didn't seem to think that was a big deal on how to combat the heat in the dead of summer. And I think there's solutions to this.
Well, yeah, as you've written about your experiences in living and working in in the heat, you know, I'm sure, that your body and mind adapt to high temperatures. If you, it's what these researchers call the adaptive model of comfort, that the range of temperatures you find comfortable isn't a fixed range of 65 to 75 degrees or something like that, but it moves up and down depending on the temperatures you've been experiencing lately, and your body's metabolism adapts to heat as well. And living in a refrigerated environment for the entire summer, conversely, undermines your ability to tolerate heat.
Well, you're right, but one of the things that gets me sort of confused is, why do the old farmers wear long-sleeve shirts?
Well, that's probably just to keep the sun off, because, you know, people who live in the desert wear, you know, loose-fitting clothing that completely covers them. So that, that's probably not. I don't like wearing long sleeve shirts in the
hell, I don't. But you know, I do wear a straw hat, wide brim straw hat. And another thing, I noticed that a lot of the young men out here working, they just have the bill caps. And I'm just wondering, if we can't take everything back to the old days. I mean, as a matter of fact, there might be some stupidity in that. But there is something to this about acclimating that you're talking about. Do you think people are ready for that out here in the country? Seems more penny-wise to do that. But up in the city, you know, there's some countervailing influences there when you're living in asphalt concrete. Could you talk about that, the problems of that?
Yeah, that's one thing. Withdrawal from air conditioning isn't going to be easy because of that. We've built cities on the assumption of air conditioning, cars and buildings, and a lot of those buildings as they stand would be uninhabitable without air conditioning. But I think this is where there are a lot of workplace issues here and things that people do get upset about. Probably the most common thing that I've heard since the book came out is people saying, I'm sick of having to take a sweater or even a space heater to work in the summertime in my office building, but they keep the damn place so cold that I have to do that. In fact, polls show the number one complaint of office workers is that it's too cold. The number two complaint is that it's too hot, so they're not doing very well on the temperature control as it is.
Right.
And there are other there's studies
go
in a
ahead.
Lot of countries showing that people who work in air-conditioned environments are sicker as well. They go to the doctor and the hospital more and tend to have longer hospital stays for various problems, infections, allergies, et cetera. And I think probably just undermining the body's adaptation to temperature fluctuation.
And another hidden thing that you that Publishers Weekly hinted about in their write-up about your book, by the way, talking about Stan Cox's book, Losing Our Cool, available at losingourcool.com. You can check it out there, and a lot of the other writings, reviews, and stuff about it. And Losing Our Cool WordPress, which has some really interesting adventures, I call them, of yours. Could you, now we are cool. We are cool people, Stan. but you actually wrote a little thing on the birth of cool in your WordPress, and with really great photographs. The birth of cool began, I guess, 1901, 1910, and it was where?
Yeah, in 1902 in Brooklyn, in a printing, a lithographic factory, because the process of printing was disrupted by the heat and humidity in summer. And a fellow named Willis Carrier, whose name you might recognize, the founder of Carrier Air Conditioning, this was his first project, and he installed a air conditioning system in that building. So that was the first modern air conditioning system. So last weekend we were visiting my son and his wife, who live in Brooklyn, and it turns out they just live about six blocks from this historic place. So a lot of people might not get too excited about that, but I had to make a pilgrimage there.
No, I was excited about it. How did they? Now, did they use Freon? How did they air condition that sky? It was looked like a skyscraper.
Yeah, the original. It was. I think it's seven floors or something, and it wasn't the whole building that was air conditioned. But in the original systems like that used ammonia. And it wasn't until, and today still some industrial systems use ammonia. Freon wasn't invented until 1930. But ammonia, it replaced ammonia because ammonia is toxic and explosive. And so it was kind of a gamble to see if you could stay cool without blowing your building up. But But then, interestingly, the guy who invented Freon while working for General Motors, a guy named Thomas Midgley, is the same guy who had the idea of putting lead in gasoline to prevent knocking. And of course, because of lead pollution, that in the 70s, 80s, we finally withdrew from lead, and we had to get rid of Freon because of damage to the ozone. So historian wrote that Thomas Midgley probably had more influence on the Earth's atmosphere than any other single organism in history.
Oh, my God. Who was that guy?
His name was Thomas Midgley. I guess he was a pretty good chemist. How would he know that his inventions would be so disastrous?
Well, he probably didn't. It was, yeah.
But probably the most interesting interesting experience I've had since writing this book, the Washington Post wanted me to write essay sort of describing what Washington, D.C. might be like at some future time without air conditioning. And so I thought it sounded kind of silly, but it was kind of fun to write it and describe. I tried to paint a realistic but fairly pleasant picture of a city where there's more neighborliness and so forth. And Congress takes longer recesses in the summer, so they're causing less trouble and so forth. But to my surprise, that it was on a Sunday in July that it ran, and immediately there were 67 pages of nasty comments on the website, and I got several hundred even worse emails from people. It's the only thing that I've done connected with the book that caused such a torrent of meanness and nastiness, and some of it was just people saying you're not going to take my air conditioning away. And then a lot of it, though, it was not long after the health care debate, and a lot of it had that kind of Tea Party-ish sound about it, like people were just waiting for somebody to say something about global warming so they could jump on them. And a lot of it was racist stuff about Obama, which I'm not sure what connection to air conditioning that had, but I found out if you can write stuff and publish it in most cities and things are cool, but in Washington, well, and then it ran the next day in the Arizona Republic, and so I think a lot of the hate mail came from Arizona, where people are pretty fond of their air conditioning.
Well, that's one of the jokes that I find going. It's a sick joke, of course, for a sick planet. But I'm blown away by the response that I was wondering about that response that you would get to something like that because, excuse me, it seems to me that people in the city are adverse to it, but people in the city like Washington D.C. would find it, you know, you can just look at the old films of the civil rights struggle and in the 50s and 60s, and there's pictures of the Washington, D.C., and it was a pretty rough place to live in at the time. And I get for a place that was basically built on a swamp, I'm always amazed at the response people get, especially like you. I was sort of surprised that they would, did they respond to you because you were from Kansas?
Well, no, in fact, a lot of people, but because it didn't say where I was from, and a lot of people who read it assumed I worked for the Washington Post, so they were all saying, yeah, I bet you wrote this in your air-conditioned Washington Post office, and somebody wrote and said, well, why don't you go try to live in a place like India without air conditioning and see how you like that? And I've lived in India for about 7 years, so that was the only one of the messages I had to answer just to let them know that.
What did the people that commissioned your article, what did they have to say about that response at the Washington Post?
They were kind of shocked as well. I don't think they expected that level of response. It got more, I guess for that week, it got the most page views on the site. So I guess as long as they were making money, they were happy.
You're not just preaching to the choir when you publish in the Post or in the Arizona Republic newspaper or any of these others. Mother Nature Network ranked you as your book, Losing Our Cool, as being one of the 10 most important books to read in 2011, the year 2011, published in 2010. However, I was like wondering, What are you getting from the choir? And I wanted to ask you your current observations about Brownback and the Coke industry, Inc., and out of Wichita. How does it fare for our Kansas people here in where we live? I mean, do you think there's anything to this? You know, I've listened to Glenn Beck. I'll try to warm this up a little bit for you. Listen to Glenn Beck to monitor him. I don't listen to him every day because, really, listeners have to listen to the first 15, 30 minutes, and then that's it, you know.
Right.
But he is really big into climate change
right.
denial. And I just got the Topeka Capital Journal, our daily newspaper in Topeka. Governor Brownback has declared a shield, that's the headline word, shield, over really – huge parts of Kansas from being threatened and destroyed by wind turbine farms. I guess those are threatening us. And Governor Brownback has put a shield over large parts of Kansas, including the Flint Hills, which is probably one of the windiest places in the United States. And I just can't help but think that the with the prices of gasoline are as they are, and I don't think they're going to go down for a while. What do you think? Where are we at? You know, in terms of learning.
Well, we're a long way from learning. The main lesson that we're going to have to learn eventually, which is that we're going to. And before the next few decades are out, we're going to have to be living on a small fraction of the total amount of energy that we use today. That's something that people in neither major party or hardly anybody else is wanting to talk about. And it's because, of course, that means getting into the issue of economic growth and the fact that the growth in no organism or population of organisms can continue to grow indefinitely, not just in numbers, but in our consumption of resources and the waste we generate. But that's exactly what we're going to have to talk about. Politicians they talk about growth all the time because that is sort of their safety valve. If they are able to promise growth, then they don't have to talk about equality or redistribution of wealth and resources. They can just say, well, growth will take care of it. The rising tide will lift all boats. But if we're oil, coal, natural gas, none of those are going to last forever. We've already passed the peak of oil production, and the other peaks are coming. Whether or not we decide to do something about global warming, and for a lot of other reasons besides global warming, we're going to have to cut back the planet's total economic activity. Now, there are a lot of people who can't afford to cut back because they're already living right on the edge and, in fact, need to be able to consume more. So that inevitably is going to need to lead to an economic system that takes from the rich and gives to the poor and gives everybody an equal opportunity. And that's something that people in neither party want to deal with. In fact, the Tea Partiers and the conservatives, they're finally, after many years of not hearing it, we're hearing the word austerity and frugality and so forth, which is good, but it's only being applied to basically to federal and state governments and to people, low-income people. That's who is supposed to practice austerity, but corporations, wealthy people, and so forth, it's not being applied to them.
Well, I agree with you. The new word that I've been picking up, the term, is austerity hawks, because it sort of describes not only the hawks about security and war abroad and in foreign countries, but they're hawks about starving the poor out and here in this country, and I think sort of dumbing us down too by Topeka, Kansas, our capital. They're shutting down three elementary schools and USD 501, and there's, I guess, an estimated 1,600 teachers and personnel in our public school system just in this state alone who have been laid off or phased out, and this just in the last year. And it's just an outrageous, crazy time. And I've got a whistleblower, a caller. Now, listeners, you can call in area code 646-716-8652 for questions with my friend and probably, I think, one of the most underreported environmental writers in the state of Kansas, Stan Cox. We're talking about his latest book, Losing Our Cool. However, we're going to go on into a little bit more grassroots stuff. I'd like to talk about the Land Institute and perennial fruit food crops later, but maybe my whistleblower guest, I'm going to bring him on now and see if I can get him on. He is a whistleblower who works in an electrical worker who works in the sewer and fresh water, for lack of better terms, treatment facilities here in the state of Kansas, the big cities. I mean, we're talking big city sewer and fresh water treatment. Welcome to Radio Free Kansas. Can you hear us?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yeah, you're on. Well, feel free to ask Stan any questions you want and tell him what you see and heard.
Well, you call me. What do you want to talk about? Shit water?
Yeah. Talk about what you see and hear, and let's see what Stan Cox has to say about it.
Oh, well, one of the concerns I have with the funding in the state and federal level in a serious decline and no money, and yet everybody's heard the term or heard the phrase that their water plants are in bad shape, you know, because they're old, outdated, they're past their due date. And I see it. They are. A lot of them are in really bad shape. And if they ain't got the money to fix them, they're going to, I mean, eventually these systems do fail. The stuff that we work on mostly is when the systems do fail and we get called in to come and fix stuff because it don't work no more. And if that starts happening on a widespread level, I think it's going to cause a lot of problems. If you don't have fresh water to drink or you can't flush your toilet and you got sewer problems, your toilets don't work, no way to treat the sewage, I mean, that's a pretty big deal. I'm hoping the government is smart enough to make contingency plans, and obviously they can't let this go, and they can't just let it fail because it's such a necessary part of society. But on the same hand, you hear them talking about cutting funding, and they ain't got no money, so if I don't get paid, I ain't going to go fix their shit. Are you still there?
Yeah. Mike? Did we lose Mike?
No, he's there. Mike?
No, here. What do you think of that?
Well, that's exactly right. If there is any essential function of government, it's ensuring clean water to residents of the city or state or wherever you live, and that I think the fact that these so-called austerity hawks are willing to abdicate that responsibility is as good an indication as any that a lot of people in government now see their role as enriching some people in the private sector and keeping their taxes as low as possible, and it doesn't really matter whether the common good is being undermined. As long as they can keep the wealth where it is, they're even willing to go so far as to let us have our children being undereducated and having poor quality water or no water at all coming to our homes.
Well, the whistleblower guy on the other line, he'll tell you about these sewer facilities. Tell him about it, will you?
Oh, I'm watching these facilities that were built in the 50s, and the electrical disconnects and junction boxes are completely rusted and rotted away, but they've managed to hook the wires back up. So you have a rusted piece of pipe with wires hanging out of it, and they've got it kind of wiring those back together, and it's still working, but like, and the facilities are rusted out, and you know, we've rebuilt some of those, and I've seen a lot of serious dilapidation in a lot of different municipalities that, quite frankly, I'm surprised a lot of them are still running. And I really don't think that the issue is being addressed because for as important as the freshwater and wastewater industry is for the cities and towns, it doesn't get as much attention as it deserves. And it is a concern of mine, of course, because I work in the field. But a lot of people that I know that don't work in the field I'm already hearing concerns about people just wanting to get a house that's on a well for fresh water. Or at least, they're curious about how much it costs to drill a well for fresh water because they can put a hand pump in and they don't have to pay the every month you get a bill for your water bill for the city water. And I know mine's about $35 to $50 a month, and I could do without that extra bill. You know, times getting hard. And honestly, some of these freshwater plants, I've seen the freshwater they produce and the wells that they pump the water from and or the rivers that they get their water from. And, man, I don't even know if I want to drink the water, because the water comes when you pump it out of a well. It's all brown and that. It looks like some dirty river water is when it comes out of the well. Now, fortunately, where we're at, when we pump water out of our well, it's clear water, and it tastes good. But a lot of these towns I've been to, when they pump water out of a well, it looks really, they got a lot of iron, so it looks real rusty and has a lot of sediment because they don't have a clay. And then they treat and refine that water. And then I know other towns, there's some towns close by here that pretty much the entire city of, you know, 1,500, 1,800 people, they don't even drink the water, fresh water produced, because it's poisoned with clown chemical, and they don't trust it. I don't blame them. I wouldn't drink it either. A lot of people I know got these reverse osmosis filters. I think it's, and I'm not trying to do any advertisement, Berkey, B-E-R-K-E-Y, I believe, makes this filter, and that's what most of the folks in some of these towns use. They get their tap water that's treated from their local freshwater plant, and they run it through one of these Berkey filters, and then they can drink it, and then I guess they got to boil the ceramic elements every so often, but that'd be the way to go. But of course, I work in the industry, but on the other hand, I've also had a great concern about it, because fresh water and wastewater, or just taking care of your waste, is obviously important to anybody that is in the know for everybody's health. But a lot of throughout history, taking care of your waste, human waste, animal waste, if you don't keep it cleaned up and taken care of, that infuses disease and it can spread real rapidly and be very unhealthy for children and elderly, and it can cause a great problem throughout a community or society in general. So they are of great concern to me on both levels. Work tied up. If the government doesn't have money to fix up their plants, the some of the basic fabric of society, I guess it won't have any work. But on the other hand, if it gets that bad, it's going to be bad. So I want people to be in the know. About it. You gotta know where your water's coming from, how clean is it, and knowing a little bit about taking care of your waste. It's pretty important.
No, that's a whistleblower. Now he's talking, Stan, he's talking about Johnson County, Douglas County, and I think he's worked out west too, out in your area of the woods in Salina. But the point is that he's seen most of these wastewater treatment plants, and they're being dilapidated. And ironically, the more privatized companies, he's told me, the private companies that are doing this, Water One is the name that comes to mind to me. Water One is exploring autonomous, or I would call them energy autonomous. They're using methane gas from the sewers to power at least the electrical generation needs of the plant itself. And when this whistleblower first told me about this, I began thinking, and he'd come back and tell me as the place is being built, and then later I saw it on television. I'm beginning to wonder if this is like something like the Air Force and the military are doing. They're preparing their facilities for some sort of energy autonomy, and the rest of us be damned. And I just wondered, how would we see that? I mean, I'm seeing that now. Do you see that? And how would... how would this affect people in the United States as well as Kansas? And before that, we've got another caller, 913, if you'd like to visit, just press 1 and I'll put your hand up. So, Stan Cox, what do you think? I mean, are they preparing, do they know something that we don't? And let's not, I don't want to sound paranoid, but I'm wondering about why they're all preparing to be what I call energy autonomous.
Yeah, we one of the landmark accomplishments of modern civilization has been to ensure that everybody has access to clean water, and the fact that in a country with as much wealth as this one, that you know, things are having to be jury-rigged and people are in, having to worry about cleaning their own water and so forth is a pretty sad commentary. We've got, when it comes to bombing water treatment plants and utilities and so forth in Afghanistan or Yemen or other countries, there are unlimited funds for that. We never cut those budgets, but it's really a sad state of affairs when something that is that technologically there's no problem. We know how to have a secure water supply, and if we're just too cheap to do it because we're wasting money on tax cuts and the Pentagon is ridiculous. And I know the you know, there have been reports from that were prepared by or for the Pentagon about how to ensure a secure, resilient energy supply for military operations and projecting a lot of upheaval that's going to come with climate change and how what the military response should be and so forth. So we're the very things we need to be worried about, energy resources, climate change, et cetera, it ends up being people in the Pentagon who are probably paying more attention to it than anyone.
That's not good.
No, not good at all.
I have a question, if I may, Stan.
Yeah.
I'm curious as to when, or is our government going to maybe start thinking about educating and sort of slowly breaking in the masses here in the United States of the letting the people in on this little secret that they know, and they're using so much resources, media and whatnot, to help the Americans not believe that this is going to happen. Why? I mean, most people I know, they don't believe in climate change or global warming. They think it's a crock of shit, and they'll get mad at you if you try to educate them about it. And so, is the government, and I think, you know, the media and the government are sort of hand in hand, and they're part of the reason why everybody believes this, and they're making us believe it. Why? So we keep on buying the gasoline and pretend everything's fine, let them go on blowing up other countries' water plants. And I have severe problems with that behavior. It's our own government doing it. But my question basically was, do you have any knowledge of our government planning on educating our own American people about what's going on? When are they going to do it? And you get the idea. That's what I'm curious about.
Well, I wouldn't hold my breath on that, because even the most enlightened people, the few of them that there are in the federal government, in the Congress or the executive branch, even if some of them really do see what's looming ahead, they aren't able to find any way to address it without a major overhaul of our the way our economy operates, and they don't. No politician is going to stay in office by telling Americans, look, we're all going to have to live in a way that uses less energy, which we consume less. Everybody can't have and do everything they want, and that we're going to have pretty massive transfer of wealth from the wealthier parts of the economy to the less wealthy if we're all going to get through this. I mean, that's obviously a suicidal thing to do politically. You probably recall Jimmy Carter in the 70s giving it a fairly mild message, but in that vein, anyway, about having to do with less and cutting back. And he had, he and Nixon had standby gas rationing plans and so forth. And it was, as much as anything, was what brought down the Carter presidency. And presidents and members of Congress have learned their lesson very well. And so they want to talk about green-collar jobs and smart this and that and all these pie-in-the-sky ideas that avoid the basic question of the fact that we need to run on as a lower energy society.
Yeah. It's not hard to get by with, and you can still do it well and enjoy life, really. I mean, it's really not that hard, but we haven't, you know, the modern Americans haven't been raised that way. They're scared of it. And, but it's not that big of a deal. It's not that hard.
I've heard, you know, there are a lot of people out there who realize that that kind of life could be actually more rewarding and so forth, but in the political arena, you just can't talk about it.
I'll tell a little story here. My neighbor lives in a 10 by 15 foot shack that he built from material he acquired for free. And for a shower, it looks kind of like an outdoor a tower that you would set up a skeet throwing machine for shooting trap, shotgun, play fishing. And he's got a cut on top of that. He put a couple 55-gallon metal barrels, painted them black, put in the little plumbing rig so he can turn the valve open and shut the valve. And he's got a little shower curtain. That's where he takes his showers. He does have electricity hooked up on the grid. And he heats with wood, and he has a propane tank backup for the winter, and he's got a little window unit air conditioner, and he survives for next to nothing. He's got a regular job. He usually, if the weather's good, he rides his motorcycle to work, and he's saving tons of money, and he's awfully green, and he's happier than heck. And I iconicize him because, I mean, man, that's pretty nice to be able to, I mean, You don't spend very much, and you still have a great quality of life, and you don't have a big carbon footprint. It's cheap and easy, and it's enjoyable, man.
Yeah, I heard from the author Richard Heinberg recently, which for some reason astonished me. As recently as 150 years ago in this country, 65% of the energy expended came from muscle power, either human or animal muscle power. And that's just mind-boggling. It must be only a tiny fraction of 1% today. But you know, we were able to build. You know, that was the time when we were building the economy that we've been living on today, and it is possible to have a civilization built on with a lot less fossil energy, but the sort of breakneck, out of control growth that we've seen in the past half century is all totally dependent on fossil fuels.
Exactly, and I think we would have a healthier society if we started to use a little more elbow grease and less gasoline.
Yeah.
Well, go ahead.
I was just going to say, working construction as I do, I get I at least get a daily dose of exercise, but I'm 32 years old and I'm out of shape because I don't actually do any cardio exercise. But you know, I walk stairs and do some physical activity, but I'm in terrible physical condition. My diet should be better, but these are all things that are going to have to be considered. But the physical labor, yeah, it doesn't take that much. And it's enjoyable. I enjoy going outside and working in my backyard and taking care of cleaning stuff up, making it look nice. You know, and you do it all by hand, and it's very enjoyable to give you something to do, really. I think that Americans need to slow down and take their time and enjoy their world, the earth. People don't respect the earth and they don't understand what it's for. They just drive across it on asphalt
Speaking of the earth, could you tell us about the work going on at the Land Institute? I tried to explain it to my whistleblower friend here. Something to do with perennial food crops. Could you talk a little bit about that, Stan? What is the Land Institute? It's located out near Salina, Kansas. But what is it? And tell us a little bit about your work there.
Well, we're trying to build an entirely new way of practicing agriculture because a lot of the damage that is done to soil and to water and to the atmosphere by modern day industrial agriculture is not just a very recent phenomenon. Agriculture being based on tillage of the soil, as you know, has been wrecking civilizations for millennia, you know, going back to what present day Iraq used to be, the Garden of Eden, and now it's a lot of it is a desert. So our goal is to look at natural ecosystems like the native prairie, the rainforest, other the types of landscapes that covered the earth before agriculture came in 10,000 years ago. Those systems have no soil erosion. They use water and nutrients very efficiently. Can we design an agriculture that runs the way those systems do? The two main components of natural systems that differentiate them from Kansas cornfield, for example, are that all of the plants, virtually all of the plants on those landscapes are perennial plants that live for multiple years and don't have to be reseeded. And you have a lot of diversity. You don't just have one species being grown over hundreds of acres. So that's why we're working to breed perennial food-producing crops to be grown in an ecologically sound way, so that we've had 10,000 years of agriculture. At the rate we're going with the population of the earth and industrial agriculture, we're not going to have another 10,000 years. We'll be lucky to get another half century or century before our soils are gone. So, but before we can get to that crisis point, we hope to have developed the hardware, you might say, for a different kind of agriculture.
Interesting. We're speaking today on Radio Free Kansas with Stan Cox, author of his most recent book, Losing Her Cool. We have a caller with his hands up. It must be a Skype number, 111. You've got your hand up. Welcome to Radio Free Kansas. You're on the air with Stan Cox.
How you doing?
Hello? Hey,
yes,
fine. Go ahead.
Yeah. I agree with what you guys are saying. Yeah.
Go ahead. You're cutting out a little bit there.
I'm cutting out? I agree with what you guys are saying. I would just say that before we can, you know, as far as clean energy and everything else goes, I'm in total agreement with you in agriculture, but before we can do anything, you know, the people in this country need to take the country back. You know what I'm saying? Because it's like, you know, we live in this republic, but the republic's not ours. It's owned by somebody else. And in, right. as
You're cutting out again, dude.
Say again?
You were cutting out again.
Okay. Can you hear me better now?
Yeah, we got you.
Okay. I was saying that as long as the politicians are being bought off by corporations, you're never going to get the funding to be able to do this green stuff as much as you want to. I mean, we have moved in ways, and I'm glad to hear that there's certain technologies that are being developed for our agriculture and so forth. But we seem to have this problem here where we're in this country where we're running around the issue, and the issue is we need to take the republic back, and the way to take the republic back is by taking, you know, our right and our votes back from people who are buying it and wanting to export it somewhere else so that we can't say what we're doing in our own country. I mean, the railroads, the clean railroads have been cut because people don't have enough money. They don't have enough money because industrial complexes that are multinational, they're not American, are moving their jobs everywhere they want to go, which is fine. But as an American citizen, I can't turn around now and say, you know, don't do that because I'm not in control of the process. So I think the first thing that we need is to take back control of the process and we can get more of this stuff done. Because this is the stuff that really does need to get done. This is an important issue to our government, to our people. But you know, we don't seem to have control of our government. We the people are the corporations now. It's not we the people anymore. So you know, I mean. I hear a lot of the issues that are out there, including this one with green energy, and I keep thinking to myself, when are we going to stop and turn around and say, you know, hey, we sold out, and now the people who own the joint and are being bought off are calling the shots, and we're sitting here talking about clean energy and the poverty and no jobs and all of these things, and it's like, hey, man, you don't have ownership anymore. You know, you're you know, it's time to take that back. Yeah.
The people of America need to be. This is the whistleblower talking now. The people of America are not educated. They've been brainwashed by the media, in my opinion. And the American people need to be educated to the truth, and that is the basis. That's what's going to start what you're talking about. Us taking over our government. I mean, us the people running the government. The people have to be informed and educated about what's going on before they can be efficient enough to run the government. And the only people that are informed and know what's going on are the rich corporations, like that. I agree with what you're saying, that are delegating what the politicians do, and they have made a big campaign of keeping the American people uneducated and brainwashed, in my opinion, so to speak, on what the American people believe. And so,
well,
to answer your question, That's it.
Yeah, American I agree with. I'm sorry.
So the American people have to wake up and have to educate themselves, and apparently the government, and the media ain't going to do it. You have to do it yourselves, America.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of different media out there. I think you know the media. I understand your point, but I think the media is sort of like a red herring because it's like media is. You know, sells soap just like everybody else, and they're going to report on what they think you want to hear. And if you're not telling them, hey man, we want to hear about this. Hey man, we want to talk about this. Then they're going to report on, you know, whatever else is going on that they think is going to sell their product. For the most part, there are media outlets out there, obviously, that are. have their own agenda and their own point of view. But most media, you know, they're selling soap, just like any other television show or anything else. But there is the internet. I mean, we've got more access nowadays to information than we've ever had before. Yet we seem to go around in circles rather than concentrating on the main issue. And I do agree that we do need education, but you know it seems like we're constantly in this divide and conquer game rather than putting it logically into context and saying, you know, before we do this, we have to do this. I mean, if you go outside your house and it's raining, you have to figure out philosophically, well, wait a minute, there's rain coming, there's water coming from the sky. Psychologically, you figure, well, now what am I going to do? Well, there's a shelter over there, so I'm going to walk over there. And then you take the procedures to do it. You don't sit there and say, well, you know, this is nice. I'm going to sit here and catch pneumonia while the grass grows because it's going to help, you know, the ecosystem. You take the first steps first, if you follow what I'm saying. You know what I mean? And I'm all in favor of the ecosystem, but I mean, I hear all kinds of things, war and ecosystem and jobs, and it's like, we sold, and I think part of what we sold was there was a time when we were offered the idea to pay for our own elections, and people said, no, we'll let the corporations and let them go and raise their own money and do whatever they want to do, and that's where they bought it. It's like, imagine if you lived in a household and somebody came and they said, hey, man, you know, you're going to get free rent, and here are the terms and the conditions of the deal. And you go, oh, yeah, great, I got free rent. That's fantastic. Okay, and then they come knocking several years later, and they say, well, you know, you didn't attend any of the meetings to vote, and some of the conditions have changed, and now we're coming in to take your television set because the people who own the building have the right to your television set now because, they own the apartment.
Wait.
I mean, it comes straight.
If I could interject, I'd like to interject something because you're
– sure.
I think what you're describing is the dysfunctional state, and I'd like to hear my guest, Stan Cox, comment a little bit about this, but first I'd like to throw this at you. I think you're commenting about the dysfunctional state of dissent in this country. You're talking about it's like a herding cats. I noticed here in Kansas and in Kansas City, Missouri, there's a period here we've been going through since the Bush 43 years where – many people were going in different directions on terms of what to concentrate on, anti-war work versus energy work versus, and people get disparate. They're thrown in 100 different, they throw themselves into 100 different directions. And one of the things I've found is a key part of talking to people about principles of unity are, one, anti-war, because primarily that's the engine that runs the corporate state and the military-industrial complex and all that, and autonomy. In turn, that's autonomy towards food production, you and your neighbors producing food or learning to produce or discuss it and start, even if it's just a small garden plot, talking about being autonomous, cutting down, using less and less energy. It could go to all kinds of things, including, you know, not using your car hardly at all, if ever, you know. But autonomy is a big issue. Autonomy where, you know, it comes a certain point when you get it, even if the vast majority of citizens don't vote, necessity, as, you know, Frank Zappa is, you know, the mother of invention, I think necessity is going to bring people towards that. And it's sort of like you gotta get yourself on a footing where they can learn from your example by being autonomous. And autonomous is part of, you know, it's all round thing. It's, you know, not being as dependent on energy as you were before, learning to live well with less, grow food as much as you can. You know, it's a very difficult subject to breach, but I think when you begin there with autonomy, individual autonomy, it starts breaking down the barriers among out here in Kansas, at least, with people. There's a wellspring of solidarity I've discovered here in Kansas since starting my show and doing and moving out here on my 10 acres among my neighbors. Now, a lot of my neighbors don't dig this, but they all understand it, especially the corn farmers. I think they're more worried about people listening to my kind of talk about autonomy than they let on. And it's just like our Governor Brownback this today declaring huge swaths of Kansas is off limits for wind turbine farms. When I know just down the road, less than 3 miles from me, there's a guy with two wind turbines he put up for his place. And autonomy doesn't come from nowhere, but in a certain way, it's a root link. And I'd like to hear if you. Let me ask Stan Cox, what do you think about that, Stan? You're still there.
Yeah, I agree with you completely, and I agree completely with our caller that purely technological solutions are not going to be sufficient, that there does have to be a total overhaul of the political and economic system, because even if you have increasing numbers of people voluntarily practicing autonomy, there's still that huge power structure out there that exists for the purpose of enriching a small number of people based on the labor of the majority of people and on exploiting the Earth's resources, and it is not going to go away on its own. We really do need to have a total inversion of the economic system, and it won't matter if the Land Institute produces perennial plants or if the wind machine manufacturers go into a building spree. None of that is going to matter as long as we have this huge disparity in power and a small number of people owning the economy.
Well, I agree with you, sir, about both of you gentlemen, about autonomy. I think that it's a wonderful idea. But when you, sir, mentioned Brownback, was saying no wind turbines, and you have a friend down the street doing wind turbines, I think that's great for him. But Brownback works for you. He works for you, or he's supposed to work for you. You know what I'm saying? So why is he turning around and saying no wind turbines when he's supposed to work for you? In actuality, he's been bought up by corporate America. But the bottom line is he's supposed to work for you. And this is my problem. I mean, we the people, our country first, my country first. McCain ran on that slogan. And I think to myself, are you kidding? I mean, come on. If it's my country first, then let's take our country back. Let's just take it back. Stop taking the money. Stop allowing the politicians to be bought off by the people who want to be able to multinationalize who are not American. You and I are American. The truckers are American. The railroads are American. But there's a lot of multinational countries. There's like 42 of them. They're not paying any taxes. And they'll go anywhere, and they really don't give a damn whether they're here or not. If they can go over to Indonesia or India or wherever and stay there, I mean, it may be a little inconvenient. America's got a little bit more resource in ways, but if they had to, they'd go and they'd do it, and they're doing business over there for sure. But they'd go live over there if they had to, because they really, they've got the big money, and they want to suggest the idea that they don't need us. I reverse the suggestion. We don't need them. Okay? We can, there are many companies that we can build right here,
Oh, really? Well, I agree. We can deal with them, but let's give an example. You're going back to Governor Brownback. His largest contributor is a family of billionaires out of Wichita, Kansas, who claim that they are, and they're saying the same thing that you are, ironically. Now, I'm not everything, but they're saying this thing about liberty and smaller government. No, you didn't say that. But they're, you know, the Koch brothers are from, and they're not. You know, if they might be exploiting oil resources in other countries, buying up super tank oil tankers, parking them offshore until the gas gets up high enough that they can put it into their own refineries down in South Texas. But Koch brothers are the largest single contributors to the Brownback campaign as well, and they give money to, I got news, 20% of their political donations went to the Kansas Democratic Party. And I think Stan was talking about this, the duality or the duopoly of the plutocrats. Brownback uses religion like you wouldn't believe to gain the voters in this state. The majority of voters that voted, and the majority of people did not vote in Kansas, but the ones that did vote are enormously whipped up and brought into voting about these socially moribund policies, abortion, homosexuality, all that stuff really hits these people in a place where I don't know where to go, but they all vote for Brownback, and they just don't look at the Koch brothers as a problem because they're in Wichita. They're here.
I don't know if you're saying the Koch brothers are or aren't a problem. I think the Koch brothers are a problem. I think the Koch brothers are probably the reason he doesn't want wind turbines, because while they may be doing their refinery, they're doing a lot of exporting businesses overseas as well. And they're one of those type of people, one of those groups of people who it's like, it's my money first and you know, your government second, you know, and there's a lot of political organizations out there dedicated to the Koch, you know, that the Koch brothers founded and started to try to keep people going down this road so that we can just keep on exporting, you know, out of this country. And it's like the people of the country, again, $35 billion to oil subsidies in this country to the oil companies, and it's like, for what? It's like, we need you to come in here. We don't need you. I mean, I don't know if anybody's taken a look at the stock market lately, but there's a lot of little companies out there that are very, very hungry, and if you offered them the proper solution to come in here and drill the oil or natural gas, or if you want to go clean, whatever, they do it. There's plenty of people out there who want to be able to build and are hungry to build up, and they're not huge conglomerates at this potential, you know, they're small business, mid-cap businesses and so forth, who would be glad to come in here and take over for Exxon if Exxon would like to leave. Of course, Exxon's not going to leave. They just want you to believe that without them, you can't survive. And I say to Exxon and people like that, I can survive fine without you, okay? You can go and you see if you can sell as much gasoline and oil in Indonesia and China as you do here, because there are 50 states here. And that's where we have to come down to as a people. It's like, you know, there are 308 million people in this country. We are a major consumer of everything. And the people that are selling us this stuff, you know, act as if we need them somehow, and that we can't go out and within ourselves and within our own structure, within the things that already exist around us, those small companies and mid-cap companies that I was talking about before, that we can't go out and figure out some way to replace them. We can replace you. Pay your taxes. Stop screwing the people in this country, you know?
The taxes have been written in such a way that the Koch brothers in 2008 sued the IRS for $20 million on shorting their tax refund. Koch brothers were entitled to a tax refund. They wanted $20 million more, and they sued the IRS, and they got their check. Now, you know, this is what I'm this is stacked so overwhelmingly among us. We've only got 8 minutes, and I want to give Stan Cox, my featured guest today, plenty of time to hear your comment on this, and then we've got to go. Go ahead, Stan.
Well, I'm in agreement with most of what's been said, although I'm not as I don't see as rosy a scenario with small business relative to big corporations. The main difference is in the scale and not necessarily the intent. Most small businesses, anyway, are their goal in life is to get big, and small businesses all over the country pay and often pay their employees crappy wages, often less than what corporations do. So I don't think we shouldn't concentrate on the size of businesses or on the necessarily on the character of the people running them, because they're all part of the capitalist system and they're all performing their function in that system. So it's the system itself that needs to be changed. The Koch brothers are obviously a serious problem, and they're something needs to be done about them. But for the most part, they're just playing the role that they have in our economy. They're doing what fat cat tycoons do, and so we Governor Brownback is doing what the agents of big business do when they get into high office. He's that is who as you say, he can garner a lot of support by talking religion and whatever, but his main role in the political system and the economy is to make life easier for people like the Koch.
The chat line had opened up. It was pretty dead, but Dr. Memory has put in, I think we've covered this, but Dr. Memory is on the chat room, and he says biofuel equals energy independence equals economic recovery equals carbon neutral, then a question mark, and then cellulosic question mark, algae, biodiesel question mark. The I think these are all desperate recipes for something that is rushing on us. What do you think? These green technologies they just Dr. Memory just listed.
Well, we could run our vehicle fleet on convert it completely to biofuel, but if we planted every single acre of cropland to fuel crops, we could run our fleet for maybe 6 months a year at the current rate and have no food. So it's that people don't get the scale of the number of calories of energy that are needed to run vehicles as we do compared with what we ingest. You fill the tank on your Prius, and that the amount of energy in there is the amount of energy that a person consumes in an entire year in the form of food. So there's always going to be, if we depend on biofuel, there will be a trade-off in damage to ecosystems and to food production. And there isn't enough. If you take the world's total grain production, there isn't enough of that to produce biofuel to run the world's vehicles.
Well, with that, I want to thank all of you, the whistleblower calling in today. Thanks for your thing about the sewers and the freshwater treatment plants here in the main urban cores, and we do have urban cores here in Kansas. I want to thank area code 111 for calling in, stirring our discussion up a little bit. You're an impassionate guy. I like you. Feel free to call in again.
Thank you.
I just want to and thank you, sir. And thank you most of all, Stan Cox, for giving us this time this afternoon out here in Podunk, Kansas. What a great thing, dude. Thanks for calling in and visiting with my friends and listeners.
Well, thank you, Mike. And to everybody out there this summer, remember that sweaty is sexy, so don't be afraid to be hot.
And with that, we're going to tell them hot church ladies out here, just get with it and get some grinding machinery. Have a great time. Enjoy the rest of the weekend. We'll be back on tomorrow at 3 o'clock with a 1997 vintage lecture by Professor Noam Chomsky on free markets. delivered to Boston University in 1997, Vintage Chomsky, on Secular Sunday, beginning at 3 p.m. Central Time. My name is Mike Adele. Enjoy your weekend. Thank you, and goodbye.
Once me lamb breaks and old Bill Brown tucks a load of corn to town, and old Jim Dobbs, the ornery cuss, he just naturally followed us. As we drift past Sam Johnson's store, Pasley asks him out the door. When Jim, he stops to smell a box, they chide at him a bunch of rocks. Every time I come to town, the boys keep taking my dog around. Makes no difference if he is a hound, they gotta quit taking my dog around. They tied a tin can to his tail and run him past the county jail. And that plum naturally makes me sore, and Lem he cussed and Bill he swore. Me, Lem Briggs and old Bill Brown, we lost no time in a jumping down, and we wiped them ducks up on the ground for kicking my old dog around. Every time I come to town, the boys keep kicking my dog around. Makes no difference if he is a hound, they gotta quit kicking my dog around. Folks say a dog can't hold no grudge, but once when I got too much fudge, them town ducks tried to do me up, but they didn't count on old Jim Pup. Jim seed his duty far and thin, and he licked into them gentlemen, and he sure must up the coat-house squaw with rags and meat and hide and haw. Every time I come to town, the boys keep taking my dog around. Makes no difference.